you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
So today on Speak Out with Tim Wise, I'll be talking to Matt McGorry, actor on How to Get Away with Murder and Orange is the New Black. We'll be talking about a lot of subjects related to issues of toxic masculinity and sexism, as well as racism and the role of white folks in fighting white supremacy. But because I'm going to be talking to Matt, I thought it would be an interesting opportunity to discuss a larger issue about the role of celebrity in political discourse. Because obviously, when you talk to someone who is an actor, as Matt is, or you talk to someone who's a singer, or in any way sort of in the entertainment industry, there will always be those folks who say you ought not do that, right? There are those folks who get angry when celebrities speak out about various things. And these folks are usually conservatives who are angry when people they view as quote-unquote liberal elites, and by that they don't necessarily mean economic elites so much as they do cultural elites, they're angry that such folks speak out and offer their opinion. These are the folks who will say, when liberal celebrities or public figures like that speak out, they'll say, why don't you just shut up and, you know, then fill in the blank, shut up and sing. Or they'll say, shut up and act. Or they'll say, shut up and play football, in the case of professional athletes, as with the current Take a Knee movement. And the idea behind all of that discourse is that celebrities ought not speak about politics. Of course, the people who say this are entirely hypocritical, because these are the same people who tell liberal or left-leaning progressive celebrities to keep their mouths shut and do their jobs, but they had no problem voting for Ronald Reagan, who was a shitty B-movie actor. Right? This is the guy from the Bedtime for Bonzo movies. They voted for him gladly, even though his claim to fame was being a celebrity. They made him governor of California first, then they made him president. These are the same people, in case you haven't been paying attention, who gladly voted for another celebrity, Donald Trump, an obnoxious reality television star and a wannabe professional wrestler, a guy who is known primarily for being known. Yes, he's a real estate developer, I get it, but as of late, his primary money comes from branding his name. That's about celebrity. The same folks who tell liberal celebrities to keep their mouth shut voted for that guy. These are people who have a problem with the Dixie Chicks criticizing the pending war with Iraq, as they did in 2003. They have no problem, however, with Toby Keith writing a song that says he's going to put a boot in your ass because it's the American way. See, both of those are political. The idea that rah-rah patriotism and cheerleading for America isn't political, but criticizing America is an absurdity. They're both political. And these folks who don't like celebrities being political only have a problem when those celebrities say things they don't like. These are people who had a problem with Steve Earle, maybe one of our best singer-songwriters in the last half century, when he wrote a ballad after 9/11 called The Ballad of John Walker Lynn. You'll remember Lynn was the American Taliban, right? The guy, the white dude from, I can't remember where he was from in the United States, but he went and joined the Taliban or whatever. And this song came out and people raked Steve Earle over the coals for that. Right, because that's injecting celebrity into politics, and it's un-American, right? And of course, if you criticize America, you're being political and you're being unpatriotic. But when Lee Greenwood sings "Proud to Be an American," right, which is also political. I mean, you're making a political nationalism and patriotism are political things. They're not neutral things. They have no problem with that. Nobody has a problem when Clint Eastwood, Charles Bronson, John Wayne, infamous draft dodger that he was, got out of service in World War II so he could continue to make movies about war and be a real badass actor pretending to be at war rather than actually fighting. But John Wayne, of course, is seen as the ultimate man's man, the ultimate image of manliness in America. So manly that he wanted to keep making movies rather than actually go to war like a lot of his compatriots of his age. Charlton Heston, these right-wingers had no problem when he weighed into the issue of guns and became a shill for the gun lobby, spokesperson for the NRA. And if you were to say to Charlton Heston, well, what the hell do you know about these issues? What do you know about the Constitution? You're just an actor, right? They would have lost their mind. if you'd issued that kind of criticism. Why don't you just shut up and act, you know, because that's all he really ever did. I mean, he played Moses. He also, you know, played the guy who comes out at the end of the movie Soylent Green and yells, "Soylent Green, it's people, it's people." Worst overacting in the history of the genre. But Charlton Heston's okay. You can listen to him, you can listen to Ronald Reagan, you can listen to Clint Eastwood, you can listen to John Wayne. It's fine when celebrities are on the right, but God forbid they be liberal. Now look, I have no problem with conservative celebrities speaking out about stuff, right? Not just because they have the right to do it, but because I don't assume that they can't be knowledgeable. I don't assume that just because they're celebrities that they're not knowledgeable. Ronald Reagan wasn't knowledgeable because he wasn't knowledgeable. I mean, that's the issue. John Wayne wasn't knowledgeable because he wasn't knowledgeable, not because he was a celebrity. Why would we assume that entertainers and athletes can't also be knowledgeable about issues? After all, we assume that television repairmen, cops, cell phone salespersons, general contractors, homemakers can be. We listen to them. We talk to them. We don't ever go around and say, "Well, what the hell do you know about politics? You're just a plumber. Maybe you shouldn't be allowed to vote." Right? If your Uncle Cooter is worth listening to at the Thanksgiving table, even though he's never studied any of the subjects he likes to pop off about, but rather he just gets his info from Hannity or Alex Jones or whatever the hell, then why can't I listen to America Ferrera or Matt Damon, who surely must know more than him, right? I mean, Hannity and Rush, for instance, are both good examples of people who have no background, academically or otherwise, in the topics about which they speak. They're no more expert than Matt Damon or Ben Affleck or the NFL players that are taking a knee who they like to criticize so much. They're just radio personalities, which is a form of celebrity. I mean, you think Michael Savage is an expert on public policy issues? The hell, he's a hateful vitamin supplement salesman with a big mouth. At least Glenn Beck had the decency many years ago to admit all this, right? He admitted he was a personality. He was an entertainer. He was, his own words, a rodeo clown. But the bottom line is, if we limited political discourse to people who actually had studied the subjects about which they like to pontificate, I guarantee you that most Trump voters would have to glue their mouths shut permanently. They haven't studied economics. They haven't studied immigration. They haven't studied healthcare. Donald Trump doesn't understand how public policy gets made. He doesn't understand the Constitution. He actually openly laments his inability to control the Justice Department and the FBI, because he apparently thought that's what you get to do as president. You get to run everything. He thinks the president is the equivalent of a king or a dictator. He doesn't know the first thing about the American constitutional system. But the people who have a problem with celebrities speaking about issues don't have a problem when these guys don't know any more than those other celebrities and they speak about them and actually get elected to legislate about them. I think what this is really about for conservatives who don't like liberal celebrities and like to call them the liberal elite is, deep down, there's a kind of bitterness that comes when you realize that most of the people who create art, most of the people who add beauty to our lives and give us things to enjoy so that our lives just aren't about the drudgery of day-to-day work, don't think like you. That must grate, right? When you actually realize that without liberals and progressives, you would have very little music or art or theater or movies or television or anything to take your mind off the day-to-day routine of your life, that's gotta hurt. That said, let's be clear, those of us who are liberal or left can't be smug about the beauty and the art and the entertainment that we provide or that some of us provide to the rest of the world, because look, our politics don't always comport with the way that we live our lives. And that's what we're discovering right now, isn't it? In Hollywood and the larger entertainment industry, with all of these reports of sexual assault and harassment. Look, it isn't enough to talk liberal or talk progressive. It isn't enough to vote for candidates who are liberal or progressive, to talk about the empowerment of women, or even to produce films that might empower certain women if you are at the same time preying on other women as part of your normal routine. It's not enough to tell trenchant and actually very funny jokes about the dangers of male predation and power if you are at the same time abusing your own power with women repeatedly. It's not enough. So while we should and must push back on the hypocrisy of conservatives when they slam the very notion of celebrities having and sharing political opinions while voting for and dearly loving the few on their side who are themselves celebrities, we should also push back against the lived hypocrisy of supposed progressives when they write checks for their politics that the bank account of their actual lives can't cash. I'll be talking to Matt McGorry about that and a lot more today on Speak Out with Tim Wise. We'll be back in just a second. Watch out. My guest today is actor Matt McGorry, best known for his role as Asher Millstone in the ABC series How to Get Away with Murder. Previously, he appeared as corrections officer John Bennett in the Emmy-nominated Netflix original series Orange is the New Black. He's a graduate of the Upright Citizens Brigade improv theater program as well, a fitness expert, former personal trainer and bodybuilder, and a graduate of the theater program at Emerson College. In the last few years, in addition to his acting, Matt has begun speaking out on issues of sexism, toxic masculinity, racism, and other connected issues of social justice, using his social media platform to raise awareness about male and white allyship and solidarity in the struggles against misogyny and white supremacy. He participates actively in the movement for Black Lives in Los Angeles and recently penned an essay on Good Men and Harvey Weinstein, the opening lines of which read as follows. We know that most men are not Harvey Weinstein, but in the words of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, morally speaking, there is no limit to the concern one must feel for the suffering of human beings, that indifference to evil is worse than evil itself, that in a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible. I spoke to Matt last week via Skype. Well, first off, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the show. I know you're a busy man, so I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Thanks for having me.
So I know most folks will probably know you principally from your role as Asher Millstone on ABC's How to Get Away with Murder, and maybe also as corrections officer John Bennett in the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. But what some are maybe only more recently coming to know about you is that in addition to being an actor who plays these kind of characters, you're also a deeply committed advocate for social justice and have been particularly outspoken as of late on matters of sexism and the importance of men taking responsibility for matters of sexual harassment and gender-based inequity. So before we get into the discussion of those issues in earnest, let me just ask you, knowing how different your current character for which you were most known is from this person who you are in the real world, especially, I think, in the category of self-awareness, because part of your character's issue, as I read your character, is a stunning lack of self-awareness. It isn't so much that this is necessarily a horrible guy. I just don't think he has any sense of himself in the world and in positionality in the world. And as someone who calls himself a feminist, someone who talks out about these issues, in the real world, you clearly have been doing a lot of self-reflection. So when you're playing a character who isn't known for that, when you're playing a character who in some ways is the opposite of that person you are in the world, how difficult is it for you to get into the headspace that you need to play a role like that? How do you do it? How do you prepare? And then how do you sell it other than just being a good actor? Like that seems like that would be very complicated. So what does it take to be able to get into that space?
It's interesting for me. I think that, you know, doing it, when I sort of delineate in my mind the roles that I do or don't want to do, a lot, you know, a lot of it comes down to, many times, even if I am playing a character that is particularly problematic, what is the framing of the entire piece, right? So like, is this character framed as someone who is problematic, or are they framed as someone who's just like, hey, you know, and I think for me, he gets enough of that pushback and sort of the framing of it makes it okay that I feel like I'm serving in a piece that is greater and still challenging those notions. But, the idea that, like, you know, that I've met, like, people who, you know, disagreed entirely with me politically, who are more in line with my character's values, who we've had conversations. And it's this very strange thing where, you know, there is even that part of me that's like, oh, maybe this is a way in for someone to hopefully learn about my politics. But also that uncomfortable feeling of like, yes, I want to reflect some of what your experience is, but hopefully to move that conversation along. But it's a very sort of weird kind of balance. I will say that, you know, being a, you know, heterosexual cis white man, you know, many times in order to play those characters, it's simply regressing to something that is sort of less evolved than kind of where I've now found myself, right? And to regress, you know, while it might be uncomfortable at times, is actually sometimes an easier thing physiologically and sort of physically to do than actually projecting in the future. And I was with someone recently as a group, one of the groups that I organized with, White People for Black Lives, which is the LA chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice, where we organize White People for Anti-Racism. We were doing sort of practicing role playing of like, what is a situation you've been in where someone has said something that is racially oppressive and you maybe didn't respond the way you'd hoped to, and then sort of interrupting that process. And one person there pointed out the fact that actually when you're doing when you're playing the role of the oppressive person, your body actually knows how to do that. and it's a comfortable physiologically position to be in than being the person that's interrupting it, even in this situation. We've been programmed, obviously, so hard to have these beliefs that they're essentially, you know, you're digging further into the beliefs of the seeds of what is already there. And then I think, you know, the other aspect of this is, as an actor, you know, we have to justify the character's behavior, because everyone thinks that they're right, mostly, right? Like, that's like, we do the things, you know, and this is the about cognitive dissonance, which for anyone that doesn't know is like this idea that, you know, when we're presented new information that tells us that our beliefs, thoughts, or actions are out of sync with our fundamental values, there's a feeling of uncomfortability. Yeah. We can either choose to reject that new information or adapt ourselves to try and make those things more in sync. And I think that's what we're constantly going through, particularly people as people of privilege, is how much am I going to let that uncomfortable idea stop me from taking this new point of view, and particularly a new point of view probably presented by people that are more marginalized than me. And that's an ongoing process that I accept will be a lifelong experience. But in that way, I can see as a character, oh, if this is your worldview, right, and everything has been handed to you, then of course you see this, this, and this.
Does that help you by playing that kind of role? Because I think that's really fascinating what you said. I mean, in a sense, it is easier because this is a character, like, we all know this guy. Like, you yeah. know this guy. We've all been this guy if we're white, straight, cis men. Even if we didn't come from the privilege that your character comes from financially, we still know that dude. Because even if we didn't come from money, we still wanted to act like we did, or we were around people who did, you know. So getting to be that person isn't necessarily a huge stretch if you're willing to regress, like you said. When you do that, do you find that it helps you in your interactions with average everyday folks who, like you said, sometimes are still in that kind of space? Can it help you to empathize with them to where the conversations you can have with them are richer because you can sort of get in their head and think about why they think what they think, not just what they think, but why? Do you find that it actually helps on an interpersonal level when you try to talk about difficult things with folks like that?
Yeah, I really do think that that's the case, right? And I think that there are actors, and this is something that's continued to kind of baffle me too, is like there are actors who also share my identities who are great at portraying characters that are much worse human beings than they are, but still don't necessarily have the self-awareness in their own lives, of, and most likely don't have very little understanding of that, given the state of how we tend to be. But I do think it offers a unique insight into that, because, and I do have these conversations a lot. And as much as, you know, I can be, I think, very combative, you know, I think online, and I do my best not to do that in an effort to like call people in rather than call people out. But for me, you know, again, like as a white person trying to figure out how can I bring more people into this movement, or as men, how do I bring more men into this understanding rather than just shaming them. And again, understanding and holding space for the fact that there are people who are very oppressive that do need to be shut down and shut out.
Sure.
But in person, these conversations, as long as someone is willing to engage with me, I am willing to engage with them. And it allows me, I think, a way to kind of just keep asking why, right? Because I've seen myself, you know, having become newly political in the last 3 years, and this is after growing up in New York City and going to public schools and having you know, a pretty well-rounded experience in terms of, you know, having friends of different backgrounds and different identities and stuff. I was, you know, completely oblivious to systemic racism and sexism and all these things until a few years ago. And that's growing up in New York City. Right. So I can imagine growing up in New York City, you know, and relative to growing up someplace where you're completely isolated, what that means. And like you always talk about, that doesn't mean we don't hold people accountable. You know, and understanding where you're coming from doesn't necessarily mean that I'm agreeing with you or want to, or I'm going to let you get away with it. But in that interpersonal dynamic, that is an essential part of, for me, saying, what is the way in for this person? Right. Because I genuinely believe most white people don't think that they're racist. Right. That doesn't mean that we can't be racially oppressive and that we're not, because, you know, we very much tend to be.
Yeah.
But to sort of understand, you know, to move beyond that kind of idea of what the intentions are. And that's the interesting thing between like the interpersonal dynamics of like characters in a television show or a film into the sort of broader implications, right? And when you move to the broader implications, that becomes like an activist piece. But, you know, when we have shows that are about, you know, police that are like, you know, good intention police and the bad intention police and all these things. We're getting into this like nitty gritty of stuff that, like, yes, makes like good television in a capitalist system where we need to produce shows every week, but is also normalizing the idea that, like, you know, the structure is not inherently oppressive itself. And no matter what the intentions are, you're still going to be engaging in that oppressive behavior because no one, you know, they don't have the show. I'm not sure if I want to curse on here.
You can say whatever you want. Yeah, it's all good.
Fuck. Yeah. You know, they're not going to, you know, have the show where it's a procedural and you see the, you know, the cop giving tickets to the guy who's sleeping in his car because he can't afford to, you know, to have housing, you know, right. Like, which is something that I see all the time. Right. And that's, but that changes our perception of what police work is too. And even makes us think that these people are constantly, constantly, constantly in the line of danger rather than the fact that, you know, mass incarceration is not based in violent offenses.
Right.
Yeah. So it's all, I mean, it's interesting. It's an interesting mix of all that. And for me also understanding that to some degree, I'm always going to compromise.
Yeah.
Right. If I, to exist in this business, there has to be compromise. And that doesn't mean that I have to shut out the idea of that this might challenge me. Right. But I can also hold that and say, what can I do within that and hold space for the fact that, yeah, I mean, this is the nature of oppressive systems, is there will be degrees of compromise to operate in it. Right. Not every piece of work I'm going to do as an actor is an activism, anti-racist, intersectional, you know, piece.
Of course.
And figuring out where I can give on that is an interesting thing too, because I don't really like to give.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the issue you raise about the importance of, obviously, when you're doing television, you're doing movies, you're doing even theater to some extent. Obviously, those rely on a narrative arc, and narrative arcs rely on character development, and they rely on these interpersonal dynamics that don't always allow us to have a clear systemic picture. It's hard to tell a story that really gets into the nitty-gritty of, like, institutional racism. It's not impossible, yeah. But it is really not what we're used to in Hollywood. It's not what we're used to on Broadway. It's not what we're used to in telling stories. And so I think one of the dangers is that people do get the impression, not only do they get the impression that, you know, police are constantly being fired upon and being killed, when in fact the systemic evidence says that, you know, although policing is certainly a dangerous job, it's not one of the most deadly jobs. The mortality rates are not nearly as high as they are for a lot of other professions.
Roofers, sanitation workers, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, commercial fishermen have higher mortality rates, and that's not to deny that it's a dangerous job. It's just to say we do have this impression that crime is always rising, that everybody's always being shot and killed, when in fact crime has gone down 40% in the last 30 years, even in those big cities that we're told to fear, right? But the other part of it is the narrative for, like, cop shows is also very much the good cop, bad cop. It's very much about thinking that if that officer is not just a raving bigot, or if that teacher, or if that employer, or if that whoever is not just a horrible, horrible person, that there's nothing bad happening, right? We get that, and then that allows us to say, I'm not like that asshole. Like, I'm really not like that bad cop. So if I'm a cop that, you know, I'm not brutal, and I'm not planting evidence, and I'm not doing that stuff, but I know it's happening in my department, and I'm not challenging it because I'm afraid of being run out of the force, which is a real fear, or yep. I'm afraid my partner is going to turn on me, which I get it. It's a real fear. I'm still yep. collaborating, but sometimes it's hard to tell that story. So I just convince myself, at least I'm not the one doing the bad stuff. And I think a lot of white folks, right, we get to that place where we think, well, we're the good white people because we don't use racial slurs, or we don't do whatever, or men who say we're the good men because we would never assault. And I know you wrote a piece about that recently, which we'll talk about in a second. So in this business, then, are there ways that maybe people in the industry could begin to think, other than just in the documentary type genre, where obviously we can talk about these things in a broader way, is mm-hmm. there a way that as you've been in the business, thought about maybe ways to weave in some of those stories about, and I mean, to some extent, both the series that you've been involved in do this about as well as they could, but what are some other things that you think the industry could be doing, that writers could be doing, producers could be doing, to show some of the complexity so we don't get bogged down in these are the good people, these are the bad people, when in fact, we're mostly very complicated. We're good one day and we're bad the next, you know, we collaborate and we resist. How do we tell those stories in your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, right, like what you're saying about, you know, again, this, our sort of binary views of who is good and who is bad, fits very much into the culture of, you know, how we've been indoctrinated not only into the system of mass incarceration, but the ideology of mass incarceration, right? To justify that these are the bad people, these are the super predators, and this is for our safety of the good people. That is very much a part of that mentality, rather than looking at, like, you know, a more sort of restorative, transformative justice model of, like, how do we get better? One of the enormous problems also in Hollywood, and Color of Change just put out a great report on this, about the race in the writer's room and stuff, is that 86% of people in writer's rooms in Hollywood are white. 90% of showrunners, like people who create shows, are white. I think 80% are white men, right? Right? So and that's not to say that, you know, every black showrunner is going to be a prison and police abolitionist, right? Right. But, you know, but I was having this conversation actually last night with a white man at this sort of Thanksgiving dinner, and we were having it as a bit of a group, and was talking about, you know, a buddy cop movie that he wants to do and this and that, and how it's not political. And I say, well, it is all political, actually, because we're still normalizing the good, bad idea. We're still, you know, it's like, imagine having like a buddy cop film like in the 50s in like segregationist South, right? Where it's like, oh, they joke around, and then in their off time, they have to, like, you know, hose down protesters, you know, right. Like, we see that now clearly. And this is something that I appreciate that you've pointed out, you know, very clearly in your work, sort of this idea of like intergenerational morality. What seems moral at one time later seems no longer justifiable. We're seeing this happening even with the Me Too movement, where lots of men who are not necessarily abusers or predators are still really checking in on their own behavior and their own intentions on these things. Yeah. You know, when you have stories that are told that often by white people and men, and as white people and men, we don't believe that our politics are influenced by the fact that we are white or the fact that we are men. Yeah. We're telling stories, and particularly in procedural crime dramas, there's less representation of people of color than even in other areas. This conversation last night was with a guy who's quite liberal, yeah, probably even progressive, you know, and this is, you know, what I appreciate, again, that you, I think, talk about so well, and so many people that you bring into the conversation, is the idea that, you know, as white people, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle of work that we're on in terms of relinquishing responsibility from a continued evolution of unlearning our bias and privilege.
I think this also is one of the things that maybe is probably very helpful for you when you're interacting with folks, in not trying to judge them. I mean, like you said, sometimes people do have to be called out, but one of the things that makes it easier to call folks in rather than engage in sort of gratuitous calling out is that when you yourself have only come to awareness around a lot of these things, as you've told me before, and as you've said in other interviews over the last 3 or 4 years, at any real deep level, it's hard, right, to go off on somebody. Like, you know, because if you know something on Thursday and they didn't learn it till Sunday, figuratively speaking, you're not really in a position to be like, what's wrong with you, asshole? Why don't you see what I see? Right. So talk a little bit about your own development on these issues. And I know we've talked about it before. I think it's really a fascinating story, how you started to think about issues of gender equity and racial equity. What were sort of the entry points for you that got you, that got the wheels turning to think about this stuff?
You know, it's interesting. I think as white folks, or as men, people with privileged identities, it can be uncomfortable for us to admit to lacks of understanding at certain points. And I think in many ways, a big part of that also is we understand that we don't have that understanding, or we haven't had it, but we haven't done the work to get to the place where we feel comfortable enough to talk about it because we understand the situations a bit better. Doing, you know, having that conversation a couple months after I came into consciousness about my own bias, I think would, I don't even think I really saw it. I saw, like, oh, these things are happening out here in the world that are terrible, you know, and I didn't see sort of what role that I played in that. And, you know, we talk about, you know, Orange is the New Black, which I was on for a couple seasons, and I was on that show, and I, if you had asked me about racism in the criminal justice system, I probably wouldn't have been able to tell you anything about it. You know, if you're like, why do you think most of the people in here are people of color? I don't know what I would have said. I probably would have. I mean, the thing is, we form beliefs around it with the lack of explanation.
Right.
And that is part of that bias, and how that happens is that the leaving out of how institutionalized racism and the purposeful entrapment of people of color and poor folks into these systems. If we don't have that justification, we create our own justification, which is racist because it is supported by all the other things. So that being said, I want the things to be very direct. I want the things to be a 13th, right? I want them to be right. Something that you have to, you have to confront yourself, you know, with when you watch it. But for me, you know, I was a part of an article early a couple of years ago for a women's magazine about male allies to women, which basically just meant that I had been on Orange Is the New Black and How to Get Away with Murder, because the bar is very, very low. And as part of that, we had to read a book that was sort of about like women in the workplace and career stuff. And I just remember thinking, oh, this is, these are things that I'd never had to think about. And then dating a woman at the time who was an entrepreneur trying to start a business, and really realizing like all this shit that you're having to deal with is nothing that I would have to deal with. And right now I see my only option is telling you, I'm sorry that you're going through that. And I'm sorry, but, and she's saying, well, this is the way that it is. And that's where the conversation sort of stops. But I think that seed planted, you know, that was able to sort of become activated later was the idea that like, oh no, if I'm not actually actively working to change these systems, then I'm simply benefiting from the fact that many women, many people of color are pushed out of industries, including my industry as an actor, which give me a distinct advantage. And so that was sort of the beginning of it. And, you know, my journey originally into feminism, or as I kind of, you know, call it more so now, I think in retrospect, was anti-sexism, right? Because for me, and my sort of the way that's evolved for myself is, if it's not explicitly, you know, anti-racist, anti-classist, anti-ableist, and all these other things, it's actually just anti-sexism. And, you know, being able to, you know, start speaking out on that very much initially, but also understanding that like my initial bias as an activist, even as someone wanting to try and be an ally, influenced how I did that work too, right? And I was very defensive in the beginning, where people would like call me out for a thing and I was like, you know, pushing back. I wish that I had, for example, a man to sort of explain this to me. I think this is where this is important too, is I often find myself reaching out to other actors who are men, or as white people who I see get in trouble for stuff, you know, on social media. And I say, look, if you want to talk about this, I have some thoughts and ideas. And otherwise, I'm just basically saying, you know, leaving this person to believe, oh, women are sensitive, people of color are sensitive, right, without actually saying, let me try to contextualize this for the person a little more and explain where I've come from sort of on making these mistakes too, so that we can actually continue to grow into that. And, you know, and I think part of what happens is, you know, in all social justice movements, the privileged people often, you know, as you know, get pushed up to the forefront. And the interviews that I was doing, you know, it was there were a lot of women's magazines that were doing, wanted to do interviews, and I was happy to do that, but also not realizing that my voice was maybe starting to like become too loud and to drown out other sort of voices. Right. And, you know, since the last year and a half, really, and since, you know, reading New Jim Crow originally about 8 months after sort of my, you know, going into the sort of anti-sexism, gender equity work, I realized this entire other section that I was totally missing out on, and trying to find sort of the marriage of those two things. And in the last year and a half, really realizing that actually to learn this stuff, I can't just be, you know, reading books in my silo and like using it as an instrument of like self-evolution, but I actually have to be on the ground to listen to the people that are at the forefront of these things, in spaces where I can be held accountable. And frankly, in spaces where, you know, like AWARE, which is one of the arms of White People for Black Lives, it's the Alliance of White Anti-Racists Everywhere. They've had this dialogue now space for 14 years, where once a month white folks get together to discuss privilege and how to develop a sense of white anti-racist identity. But having that community and having people, again, sort of on the ground, which is very antithetical to, I think, our views of change as white people, and in big part from even savior narratives and films, it's very counter to how we're viewed, I think, even as change makers, as public figures.
And how do you find the balance thinking about that issue as a public figure? Because obviously, on the one hand, when you have a platform, whether it is as a celebrity or whether it is as a writer or whatever it is, any of us who have any level of public platform obviously want to figure out ways to be accountable to the people most impacted by the things we talk about. We don't want to relinquish the platform because the platform can be really meaningful. How do you find that balance between taking up just enough space to reach people who maybe are fans of yours, followers of yours, who maybe haven't thought about this stuff yet, but who might listen to you on the one hand, and then on the other hand, becoming that symbol or spokesperson for a movement that isn't led by people like you, isn't led by people like me, cannot be led by people like us, is being led by those who were the targets of white supremacy and the targets of misogyny. How do you try to strike a balance? And, you know, are there times that, that folks have said to you, hey, you need to pull back or move forward? And how do you sort of, how do you navigate that space? Obviously, none of us navigate it perfectly, and we just have to be okay with that and be okay with the fact that when we screw up, we can take direction and we can take correction. Talk a little bit about that, because I know there will be people listening who, whether they're public figures or not, want to say more, but if they also are white and they're also male and they're also straight and cisgendered and all and able-bodied and maybe upper middle class or affluent, they might feel like either it's not their place or, by God, I'm going to go out there and be the one. And neither one of those are healthy, right? How do you try to find that balance?
It's an evolution, right? And I think I imagine that, you know, the longer I've been in it, I think the less I screw up now. But that's also because I have aggressively taken on a process of sort of re-educating myself, right? Like if I view mainstream media and just simply moving through the world as an education in how to be racist and sexist, then I have to take a pretty proactive stance to counter that sort of education. Otherwise, it's just normalized everywhere, right? And so I think, yeah, I think it really is a balance. And again, finding the people that, I mean, for me, showing up in person organizationally has been huge too, because in building with these different organizations, and, you know, I'm so grateful that also, you know, White People for Black Lives has such a strong partnership with Black Lives Matter LA in terms of what that means and what accountability means. You know, I realize that I can plug in and I can learn from that experience, right? And me previously not thinking that I needed to, is also an act of sort of being like, well, I know the answer, as opposed to being like, wait, so these are the folks who are leading the fight and they've already built this relationship. What can I learn from these people? And again, I think that often means that we have to then listen to people who are more marginalized, right? And even within the white sort of identity space, like I have to think about what does it mean to listen to, you know, white folks who are, you know, poor or working class, you know, as an upper, you know, as an affluent person, or people who are gender nonconforming, or take the leadership of women, and all these sort of biases that even in a white affinity group, you know, sort of play into that. But it is an ever-growing process. And again, I like to think, you know, I have some friends, you know, now who are other public figures are starting to speak out a little more about these things. And I like to think that I can sort of offer some of that guidance that I wish was there kind of for me at that time too, to say, hey, these are mistakes that are very common that I made. Don't do that. Here's why. And I think it ends up being, you know, there's a lot of, we have to be willing to really listen and take time and understand that, I mean, first of all, amplifying is something that can always happen. And that's not difficult to do. And that's not us taking up space typically, right? If we can amplify the voices of people that are more marginalized, then that's one great way to do that. And then I think the other thing is like committing to re-education. Committing to like anti-racist, anti-sexist and education is the only way that we can actually close the gap in that sort of knowledge that we don't have because of personal experience. Not that we can ever close it, but in having that conversation with a couple other white men last night in a sort of racially and gender mixed group, was the idea that like, okay, so you're listening now, you get that this, that we're sort of pushing back on this for these reasons. Now, what do you do with that now, right? Like, you know, you want to create a show about all women, right? But like, have we ever read a book about feminism by a woman? You know, have we ever, you know, tried to really see like, what are the, rather than just for on a show basis, like, well, let's get like a woman in the writer's room. And, but like actually also say, how do we sort of consistently make that a part of our life? And it also is hard, right? Like it's, you know, it's not as hard as being a woman or a person of color or both. But it is difficult and it's a painful process. That we sort of have to be willing to learn from. And there's a lot, you know, the media landscape, you know, and I got a lot out of this actually when I read Andy Zeisler's book, We Were Feminists Once, where she talks about a great analysis of sort of marketplace feminism, but also like, you know, celebrity feminism and male celebrity feminism as well, of this idea of how it can end up being a very sort of surface level of engagement without sort of that fundamentally deeper work, but also how the media itself elevates these things, right? Like when I'm doing anti-sexism work, I get maybe a lot of coverage, especially if it's more universally appealing to a wider range of people. But when I start talking about anti-capitalism or anti-racism, you're less likely to want to publish that, because that actually forces, you know, people to have to look sort of inwards at their own organizations. And so, yeah, it's sort of forcing those conversations. But look, there are risks associated with it. We are going to fuck up. That's an important part of the process. For me, having these groups, and, you know, Surge is a national organization, but finding community among other people to talk to, and understanding that, like, white anti-racism is difficult, but is not the same as being a person of color doing anti-racism, or just being a person of color moving through the world. But having the space and people to have those discussions with, that are important discussions, without necessarily burdening, you know, a person of color with, like, hey, man, I talked to this guy the other day, he was so racist. Like, you don't want to fucking hear about that, probably. But that might be an important conversation for me to have, of like, how does one relate to their relatives who are having these beliefs and these thoughts? So, and that's really the idea for me of, like, building community is so antithetical to the idea of what I originally started, which is like, I got this, as opposed to like, what can I learn from those folks who've been doing that work?
We're experiencing, as obviously I don't have to tell you right now, a very interesting moment in the culture where, you know, all of a sudden, I guess the country, and particularly the men of this country, are starting to actually be aware of things that women have been aware of for a very long time and have been trying to tell us for a very long time about sexual assault, harassment, about male predation, whether it's in Hollywood or the world of politics being the two most visible. But of course, it's happening in every industry. It's happening in every corner of the country and the world, really. Is there something about specifically masculinity, at least as we often think about it, that is implicated in this? And if so, what do you think that is? And I know that's a relatively easy question, but I think it's important for listeners to think about. And then how does whatever that thing is that's about masculinity, in large part, how does the power and the glitz of, let's say, celebrity culture and political culture, which are probably the two most powerful subcultures in this country, at least, feed into that problem? How do those things interact in your mind with what we're seeing right now coming out of Hollywood, coming out of DC, men engaging in predatory behavior, not only vis-a-vis women, because some of it is vis-a-vis other men, but disproportionately towards women?
We all have, as men, as heterosexual men, we have these notions that unless we're actually going against the grain are put into us, even as men that are feminists, you know, or who are working in anti-sexism. You know, the fact that we think that that can make us impenetrable to, you know, unconscious bias ourselves is a part of that problem, rather than engaging in the fact that it has to be an ongoing experience. But yeah, I think there's a lot of intersections with, right, like the idea of celebrity culture, and how that ties into capitalism, which is obviously so tied to, you know, patriarchal forms of domination, and whether it's, you know, in economics or sort of the ideology that holds it all together, of that idea of wanting to be dominant. Right. And that was something that, you know, that I experienced, I think, is very much as a sort of as a reaction to wanting to fit in to some degrees and wanting my identity to feel valued in a culture that values male supremacy. You do those things. Right. So, you know, I became a competitive powerlifter for a number of years, and I did I was a competitive bodybuilder, and building that business and feeling like that is what my identity is based in, is my ability to just like drill into something and work hard and deprive myself, you know what I mean? Deprive myself of lots of things, whether it was food or just the enjoyment of like my body, simply because it was my body and I should be able to enjoy it just because it is that. Or if it was the sort of relinquishing of actual, like, you know, a deeper level of friendship that can't be sort of reached by most men because we're so afraid to be intimate, right? We're so afraid to be seen and to be vulnerable, because for all of our lives, we're taught that that is not the thing to do. Even me, who grew up in a family where my parents would never say something like, you know, boys don't cry, I still got that message, okay. Right? And I still got that message in gym class in fifth grade when I was standing a certain way and someone came up to me and asked me if I was gay because of how I was standing. And at that time, I thought I couldn't be seen that way. And never stood like that again in my entire life. You know, I didn't think it was an accident. I don't think like my physiology or my musculoskeletal system somehow instantly evolved to never stand like that again. I think that that became internalized, and the messages with that become internalized too, which is if I'm not wanting to do this thing that makes me feminine, that makes me perceived as non-heterosexual, then I'm therefore pledging allegiance to the things that make me the opposite of that. And that is included in powerlifting and even being a self-defense instructor, which I did as well. You know, and I think understanding how to like really think about breaking that apart in ourselves is an important part of how we close that gap of being better sort of allies, and understanding that process is never ending. Right. And that simply because I profess to be, you know, invested in this fight, and because I do show up, that doesn't mean that that people can't be critical of me. You know, we're so stuck in binaries of, you know, I'm a good person or I'm a bad person, you know, as opposed to looking like, okay, how do we be a better person?
I think the danger of the binary is this idea of either I'm a person who never does that, or I'm a person who does it all the time. What's actually really critical is for us to acknowledge we are that person, but that's not all we are. Like, we are that interrupter. We are that mansplainer. We are that person who has sat by and been silent. But that's not all we are. And we can hold these things at the same time, because the thing that, like, for example, with the sexual abuse dynamics that are now coming so public at this point, finally, after many, many years of women being silenced and being afraid to come forward with their stories, I feel like people want to look at, let's say, a Harvey Weinstein or a Kevin Spacey or whomever it is. And it's so much easier, right, if we just say, these are monsters, right? Now, what they have done is monstrous, right? But the problem is, when we start saying that a person who does those things is a monster, that's actually, I don't think that's about them. I think that's about us. I think that's about us saying, and I'm not a monster. So right. If I can put Harvey Weinstein in the category where he's not even really a human anymore, or Kevin Spacey, where he's not even a human anymore, then I don't have to deal with my own bullshit. And it seems right. To me, what is scary to a lot of people, and I get it, is to realize, like, oh, you mean Bill Cosby could actually have been sort of Cliff Huxtable and also a predator? Like, both of those things can be true. How scary is that shit? That's really scary, because that means if it can be Bill Cosby, if it can be Harvey Weinstein, who by all accounts is progressive politically, whatever that means, has done good work that is liberal, quote unquote, in terms of its, you know, but if he can be that and this other thing, then that means I could be, theoretically, and you could be. And that is some scary shit, you know, right. And that to me is the deeper conversation, rather than walling it off and saying, man, these assholes in Hollywood or these assholes in politics, you know. And as easy as it is for me as someone of the left to sort of look at Roy Moore and go, oh, my God. Like, here's the deal, though. Is Roy Moore the only dude in his 30s who's fetishized teenagers? Hell no. Like, that's the culture encourages that kind of, and you hear the excuses they keep giving. Well, he was attracted to them because of their purity. And well, that's a patriarchal, misogynistic notion that is widespread throughout the culture. So until we stop sort of cordoning off ourselves from these other folks and acting as if somehow they're monsters, and actually embrace the complexity of saying good people, quote unquote, or at least decent people who are capable of good can also be capable of monstrous actions. Right. And that means we have to check in with ourselves every day to elevate the good and minimize the bad, because they're always both there. Why is that so hard, you think, for folks to embrace? Is it just that it's a scary thought? Is it just that it's so much simpler to not think about it in a complex way? I mean, what do you sense makes it hard when you interact with people who just want to think in binary ways?
Yeah, it's so interesting, right? And what you're talking about, I think there's a very close parallel to the conversation that I was having after Charlottesville, right? With a lot of white people who were saying, oh, I can't believe it. There's this interesting sort of sense sometimes of like of white anti-racism that is apparently very staunch against it, but without really sort of any looking inwards. Right. We're like, you know, fuck racist, fuck sexist, and, you know, right. As people who are maybe men and white folks, but not like, oh, how do I fit into that? Right. And where am I on that spectrum? I remember thinking initially, and this is rather naive, but when I found out about all these systems of oppression that I had no idea about, just thinking, holy shit, like, no one knows, you know, or like, I got to just tell my guy friends, and I got to tell my white friends, and we're all going to do the same thing. And then finding out that's not the case, right? And then even the sort of the not just naivete, but the sort of like sense of, you know, superiority in that thinking of like that, like, I don't know, maybe people of color and women have been trying this for centuries potentially. But I'm the guy who's like, No, they just don't know, which I think is a natural part of that sort of process and evolution. I think that I had to have those thoughts first. Initially, I have to be loud about them all the time. And in a world where maybe I had another guy who was in a similar position to me who had been there before in the way that I'm trying to do, could be like, actually, let's look at it this way. You know, that could have been avoided or minimized. My friend, Dr. Michael Kimmel, who, you know, is a professor in masculinities, talks about the idea that, you know, as real men, we are expected to, the idea that boys would be boys and we're, you know, we look out for each other and we don't say anything and we do what we do to get the girl and not the woman, but the girl, right. and all this stuff. But that as good men, you know, quote, we believe that that's about like integrity and honesty and virtue and, you know, standing in solidarity with people that are more marginalized. And we're constantly asked to have those sort of beliefs conflict at times, because being the good men actually does involve many times some, and depending on where you're at, right, like some material sacrifice. We could argue that, you know, we're talking about the top 1% or 0.001%. Yes, there is a, literally the word sacrifice is true in terms of what we're talking about, in terms of you will have less billions of dollars, right. But the level of that sacrifice is all very proportionate. I think that's a constant tension of like understanding that to thrive in a typical business sense, even in my industry, part of what is often involved is shutting up and just kind of playing along. But then again, you know, when we look at business, and this is sort of in the macro sense, when we look at a successful business, many folks, particularly white people and, you know, very wealthy white people on the top of the economic pyramid, look at a successful business as basically how much money the business makes. But if I'd expand my definition of success to understand that that has to include a sort of moral compass, and has to create space for the fact that I can, that I'm going to speak out about these things, and still understanding that I have the financial privilege and some momentum in my career to do this in a way that might have been different 2 years ago.
Well, it seems to me too that if people in a position to sacrifice, like you said, compared to a lot of people, the sacrifice when you're in that top echelon is not huge. But here's the thing: if those of us who are doing reasonably well financially are able to sacrifice a bit and take a hit, which again still leaves us with plenty of dough and we're doing what we love and what we care about, if we make that a more normative thing, right, those of us who don't have who don't have a lot to lose, and you know, there's, it's not going to be the end of the world, you know, if we step out and get some pushback and maybe lose some dough because of it, maybe that helps to shift the culture a few degrees to where people who are just average everyday folks, not public figures, not making a ton of money, can also begin to do it. Because what makes it hard for them, right? I mean, the idea of losing when you're struggling, I mean, the idea of sacrificing when you're barely surviving is obviously very intimidating. Because at that point, it's just a rat race. And at that point, you're just trying to stay ahead of the next guy. And you'll do anything, because in a system of capitalism that's rooted in scarcity, that's what you do. Maybe if the culture, however, begins to shift to a place where we think of speaking out on behalf of justice as a more normative thing, then that doesn't have to be such a sacrifice. So in that regard, that might be a way that those of us with greater levels of privilege who can afford to take that hit can begin to use that amplification of our own voice in a way that creates space for other people to be able to do that without feeling so afraid that, oh my God, if I speak out, you know, I could lose my job. I could lose everything. I could, you know, not be able to pay for my kids' education or healthcare, which is not stuff that people in that upper echelon are necessarily thinking about.
I think that's, yeah, that is that contextualizing of what sacrifice is. Right. And, you know, I don't think people are wrong in saying that the Democratic Party is not, doesn't necessarily strongly care about poor and working class white people. It's just, that's in a greater context of everything else, right? There is classism there. Absolutely. And that has to be addressed on both parties' sides, as does all the other issues.
What about, so I guess the last thing I want to ask you before we're sort of out of time is, with what's going on in Hollywood and this burgeoning, hopefully, awareness of the real epidemic problem of male sexual predation, what do you see being, you know, on the inside of this industry as the likely results of this a couple steps down the line? The reason I ask is I always worry that when we have these crisis awareness moments, that there are two ways that we can go. And I think we've seen this with some of the issues around police misconduct too, and issues of criminal justice inequity, where there's the awareness track, right, which is we're going to become more aware of how police often operate, let's say in black and brown space, and maybe we're going to have the body cameras, which will allow us to see, you know, all these things. And that's one track. But of course, you know, we know that, you know, Tamir Rice was killed on camera, John Crawford was killed on camera, Eric Garner was killed on camera, Walter Scott was killed on camera, and we haven't gotten justice for any of these people yet. So the parallel to that when it comes to the male sexual predation piece is, oh, now, you know, Hollywood will talk about this, or Congress is going to have trainings on sexual harassment or whatever that's going to end up being. The other track, which I think is the more substantive one but harder to get to, is we actually have to start having more of the target group in positions of power to make the calls, whether it's in Hollywood or in Congress, the Senate, etc., because otherwise, you know, male awareness is fine. It's certainly better than its opposite. But if men are still making those decisions, if they're still the showrunners, if they're still the producers, if they're still the ones making the decisions about what gets greenlit and what doesn't, if they're still the ones making the laws, there still seems to me a disconnect. So how do we move from the awareness track? And we'll just talk about it in regard to Hollywood, since you're in that space. How do we move from the awareness track to the space of saying, actually, there's got to be real power sharing? And that's on the production of shows, on the production of movies, all of that, from not just from the level of the showrunner and the producer, but I mean cinematographers, everybody. There's got to be some real power sharing about who's in that room. How do we get from point A to point B, in your estimation?
It's a good question, and that's a tough one. And I would say that, you know, in a lot of these sort of in this particular area, I think women will probably have more of those sort of ideas about what the sort of the institutional changes that need to happen are, right? In the same way as, like, you know, in worrying and talking about mass incarceration or police brutality, as if that's not inherent in policing level of brutality. For me, it's about sort of thinking about, like, as men, how do we uplift the demands and support the demands of the people that are most marginalized, most affected by this, while at the same time getting other people with those privileges to say, hey, maybe listen, maybe shut the fuck up for a second, and we can, you know, we can see what they're, rather than being like, I know what the thing is, I know what the, you know, what the appropriate sort of response is. So I think in many ways that's, you know, I think that there's a lot of, you know, sort of things that are happening, and I think still waiting to see what the institutional changes of these issues will be. You know, and I was having this conversation with someone last night who was saying that, oh, this so-and-so's person's career is ruined and this and that. But also, like, Mel Gibson is back, you know, and what proof do we have that he's any different than he ever was before? Like, you know, I don't know that this guy went and started getting involved in anti-racist organizing or started trying to educate himself out of his sexist viewpoints, which is what that is. But that is a great question, right? And it is part of in organizing, I've had to train myself into sort of a different mode of thinking from a sort of a mechanistic view of change that I think we are, you know, indoctrinated into through the system of electoral politics and even how we're taught that change happens in film when it's even films about activism. And really for me being like, okay, yeah, this we're not getting necessarily the things that we want for sure. And, you know, until the day comes when all people are treated equally, we won't. But also understanding that, like, you know, for me, that level of awareness and that ideological shift is something that will eventually, and I don't know when, but pull the pin out, hopefully, that will topple that thing. And, you know, I'm just saying I'm heartened by the conversations that I'm now having with other men and, like, you know, guys that are my friends and guys that, you know, still put in more effort to think about this stuff than most men do. But to actually take a real critical sort of self-reflective look on this stuff. It's unfortunate that it takes, you know, a fear of, you know, fury to put that into us. And I think that's an important acknowledgement too, right? Is to say, not just like, oh, I'm considering things now, but like, why did it take this to make me think of that? And what has been being said all along that I've not been listening to? What is the pain in there? What is the amount of labor that's gone into trying to educate, you know, people in these things? And for people who are doing it, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago, before, you know, there was even sexual harassment, you know, structures in place to even try to combat that. But I think it right. It does. It involves at some point. What I tend to think about is also this ideological shift of getting ourselves out of the place of being like, we're the good ones, we're not the bad ones. And frankly, even these sexual harassment training suits are for insurance purposes. They're not actually, if they're not anti-sexist, you're just telling people what they can and can't do, which means that like if it's 1 degree outside, like, can I do that? As opposed to if you're looking at like, does this oppress women? No, I'm not going to do that.
Right. Well, it's about what can I do and get away with? What will be? It's all transactional as opposed to based in some rooted principle. And I think that's why, you know, even the conversation that you said you had, Thanksgiving conversation you had, as small as that is, having that conversation, asking those kind of questions of someone who has all the best intentions, all these, you know, best of intentions, maybe, you know, has a great idea for something, but at the same time saying, well, what about this? Think about this. Listen to this person who you're not listening to. And you're not doing that in a pissy, combative way. You're doing it in a way of like, hey, we're in this space together. Here's just some stuff to think about. And like you said, it's the kind of stuff you wish somebody had said to you before you began to come into consciousness. And I would imagine it's something that you still want people to say to you when you slip and fall and fuck up and all the things that we're all going to do, you know, from time to time when we talk about this stuff. So I just want to tell you, I'm grateful that you're doing what you do. I'm grateful for the role that you're trying to play in an industry where I know it's not the default. And you're not alone in it, but you're certainly one of the people out there trying to do this work. And I just appreciate you for it, Matt. And it's good to talk to you.
Awesome.
You've been listening to actor Matt McGorry on Speak Out with Tim Wise. And a special thanks to all the listeners and those of you downloading the program. Tell your friends and family, please spread the word on social media. You can find us online at speakoutnow.org/speakoutwithtimwise, also on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as Podomatic, the host for this podcast. And if you'd like to become a sustainer and patron of the program, we'd love to have you. It's one of the ways that we can grow the program and make sure that the quality, both technically and substantively, is as good as it can be. There are two ways that you can help us out. One is to go over to patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and become a monthly sustainer of the program. You can do that at levels of $2, $5, $10, $20, or $50 a month. And with those donations, you'll be able to access premium content unavailable to regular podcast listeners. So that might include extra portions of my interviews with my guests or daily commentaries that I'll be recording at least 3 times a week about the day's events or week's events. Also, at higher levels of patronage, you can get signed copies of my books or videos, all kinds of different extras. So by all means, check that out at patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. The second way that you can support us is with a direct one-time donation at speakoutnow.org/speakoutwithtimwise. You can do that through PayPal, and especially at larger levels of donation, if you don't want to make a monthly contribution, that's a great way to do that. For today's episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin with Speak Out, my producer, Jamie Lynn Moeller, and Brother Ali for giving permission to use his song Gather Round from his Morning in America and Dreaming in Color album for the intro and outro music for this podcast each week. And that is where we're headed right now. And the poor and the pious get inspired.